that okay?
Yeah. This one also touches on that one.
Yeah, but we're gonna hold that until later.
Okay.
When Gomberg can be here.
Okay.
You ready? All right. House Committee on Revenue for February 16, 2015 will come to order. Colleagues, we have a number of public hearings scheduled for today, and the plan is to open the first three, which have to do with corporate minimum tax, first, and hear those bills, and then go on to the rest of the agenda. So with that, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2076, House Bill 2096, and House Bill 2107. Chris, do you want to introduce them for us?
Sure. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Up on OLIS under meeting materials, there is a document that contains a kind of one-page summary, highlights of it, actually these three bills plus another one. But the first three, so going down, starting with 2107, it declares that the minimum tax may not be reduced by any tax credits and will be effective for January 1, 2015. I guess by way of background, these bills deal with the Conway decision that allowed tax credits to be used against the minimum tax. The minimum tax was established in Measure 67, which was passed in 2010 by the voters. House Bill 2096 also declares that the minimum tax may not be reduced by any tax credits except the Betsy. And this is the 315.354 referenced in the bill. This is the old Betsy credit. And then House Bill 2076 does a number of things. First, with respect to the corporate minimum tax, it also declares that the minimum tax may not be reduced by any tax credits. Then it also makes some changes to some of the policies from the so-called grand bargain from 2013 related to the pass-through brackets and tax rates. It reduces the cap on the income subject to the lower rates from $5 million to $1 million. So that raises, that would be a positive revenue impact. And then it also reduces the work hours requirement for eligibility. Within that bill, there were a certain minimum number of hours that needed to be worked by employees for the business to be eligible for the lower rates. This lowers those eligibility requirements. And then the last three things done in the bill, it reinstates the 10.8 and 11% tax brackets from Measure 66 for the personal income tax. And it also reinstates the Measure 67 top corporate tax rate of 7.9%, which would be applicable to taxable income above $250,000. And then the last policy included in the bill is that it removes the corporate deduction for employee compensation above $250,000 if they were actually deducted.
Okay. That's 2107.
2076. I did them in reverse order. 2096 and 2107. The only policies are the corporate minimum.
I see.
And the only difference between the two, 2107 says no credits can be used against the corporate minimum. 2096 says the only credit that can be used against the corporate minimum is the old Betsy, the one that was allowed to sunset a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. And then 2076, the corporate minimum policy is identical to that in 2107. No credits can be used against the corporate minimum tax. 2076 is a much more comprehensive bill in that it also includes five other policies. Two related to the pass-through brackets and rates. This is the non-passive income from partnerships and S-corporations from the grand bargain. And then the other three policies, it goes back to the Measure 66 and 67 policies that were in effect for the first couple years, 2009, 2010, 2011. And then the new policy, if that's the right term, it disallows a corporate deduction. For generally, corporations are allowed to deduct the compensation that they pay employees. This provision would disallow that deduction for compensation above $250,000.
Thank you. I see that Representative Noss is here, so let's hear from him first, and then I'll go on with my list. Representative, thank you for attending today.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm actually excited to be back here in front of you on this side of the dais. My time on your committee was too brief. For the record, I'm Rob Nose. I'm the state representative for House District 42, where I represent Southeast and a little part of Northeast Portland. The voters in my district, Mr. Chair, and in many other parts of the state, are concerned about funding for schools and services. So to that end, I'm here today to echo the sentiments of those that are going to testify, I think, after me, in support of House Bill 2107 and House Bill 2076. Now, our state has among, if not the lowest tax rates for businesses in the United States. And even with those low tax rates, too many large and out-of-state corporations are not paying their fair share of taxes. These bills attempt to bring a little bit of tax fairness into our system and say that everyone, even big corporations who certainly benefit from good roads and properly funded schools to educate future employees and their families, should contribute. Now, most of you probably know that from 1930 to the year 2009, the minimum corporate tax in Oregon was only $10. In 2010, the voters passed Measure 67 and approved higher minimum taxes for all corporations, though still keeping Oregon among the lowest, if not the lowest, in the United States for business taxes. I brought two handouts with me, which I hope are making it around you, that sort of explain how Measure 67 works, I think, in a fairly easy, straightforward manner from the Oregon Center for Public Policy. So I think it's double-sided. So first, you know, what are your taxes going to be if you're a business? You figure out, are you an S corporation or a C corporation? If you're an S corporation, you're going to pay a minimum of $150. If you're a C corporation, you have to figure out if you have taxable income in our state. So you go to the other side. It gets a little more complicated. For that year, if you did, then you calculate the minimum tax, the tax on profits less credits, and you pay whichever is greater. Now, if you had $250,000 in taxable income or less, you pay taxes on a rate of 6.6%. If your taxable income is over $250,000, then you pay 6.6% plus an additional 1% on taxable income that is greater than $10 million. Now, if you didn't have any taxable income at all, you're still going to pay, or you're supposed to pay, a minimum tax. If you had less than $500,000 in sales, your C corporation's minimum tax is only $150. If you had more than $500,000 in sales, your tax rate is tiered. And it's a little hard to read, but you can see the box here, and that gives you what the tiers is. Again, the intent of Measure 67 was that every corporation should pay something more than $10. When Conway went to court and created or exposed the loophole, it allowed them to reduce their minimum even further if they had tax credits. A corporation that had over $100 million in sales with no taxable income is supposed to pay $100,000 in taxes. But because of the loophole the Conway case exposed, those corporations can use a tax credit and reduce this already low rate even further. And so this chart, I thought, provides a pretty good visual explanation of what's going on. I was getting into the weeds last night with a bunch of people who are a little bit more certified smart than I am, and I'm like, I'm just going to show the chart, all right? Because I think it makes it very clear what's happening is you're supposed to pay a minimum, but because of the loophole, you can reduce your minimum even further. Now, the Department of Revenue estimated that this tax loophole costs $9 million in 2012. $9 million can hire 90 teachers a year in Oregon. Excuse me, $9 million. So my guess is that it creates even more revenue loss for 2015 and beyond. We all know that our state schools are behind the curve. We have the second largest class sizes and the second shortest school year in the United States. At the same time, our state has among the lowest, if not the lowest, corporate tax rates in the country. Working families are carrying too much of the tax burden for basic services, and corporations are paying too little, including paying less than the minimum corporate tax. House Bill 2107 and 2076 would close the zero tax loophole for corporations and make sure that the largest businesses pay their fair share in Oregon. Corporations benefit from public investments in education and infrastructure, public safety, etc., and they can afford to pay Oregon's already low minimum tax rate. That's my testimony.
Thank you.
Do we get hazed in this committee if it's the first time you're up testifying, or is that just on the floor that happens?
We'll see, Representative.
Okay. All
questions,
right.
Questions, Representative Nose.
Really?
Representative Leininger, please.
I've heard about a tattoo, Representative.
Yes. No. Well, I wore a jacket today, so
you did do a marvelous job on the floor that time. So thank you for
that.
And thank you for this important information. I'm looking at the zero tax loophole graph that you showed, and it is a really helpful graph. Is it the case then that there are a bunch of companies that have Oregon taxable income of over $5 million a year that with the Conway loophole are paying less than $20,000 in corporate tax?
So here's the thing, and this is where I'd ask you to either get someone from the Department of Revenue or someone that studied this up in front of you a little bit further. I can't actually tell you who's paying what in this state because we don't have any corporate disclosure. So this is somebody's best estimate of what taxes we're collecting and then what's being reduced based on the aggregate. All right, so I bet Chris or somebody from the Department of Revenue can explain this a little better than I can.
Please, follow up. Yes.
So at the beginning you described that could you repeat the statistic, between 1930 or something and 2010, the
2009.
Tell me what that was.
When voters passed Measure 67, we changed the corporate minimum from $10 to $150.
And then if you garnered
greater income, then there were tiered rates, right? So
right.
The most you're going to pay if you're a corporation that's doing $100 million worth of business, your tax, if you didn't have any taxable income, your minimum tax is $100,000.
May I ask some follow-up?
Yes, please. Yeah.
So was I right in hearing you say that from sometime in the 1930s or 40s, there hadn't been a change in the corporate tax
you
until
are,
2009.
You are correct.
Could you say that statistic
yes.
again?
So from 1930 to 2009, the corporate minimum tax in this state was $10,
yeah.
not adjusted for inflation.
So as to the Conway loophole, is there any legislative history that suggests that when the legislature passed the tax changes or that was ultimately referred out, that they intended to have the Conway loophole and corporations go below the minimum tax, or was the idea that the minimum tax should be the minimum tax?
I'm hoping not, Chair Barnhart and Ann Leininger, but I wasn't here and during the 2009 session when this was passed. But I sort of believe that we set up a system where everybody's going to pay a minimum. And so Conway figured out that they had these credits and that there was the law that we passed wasn't clear enough, and I think they went to court, and here we are.
That question came up during the interim at a time when Vice Chair Vicky Berger was here, and we had a conversation about that. My recollection was that this was intended to be an absolute minimum and nobody could go below that. Representative Berger, who since retired, has strongly disputed that and said that she thought that it was part of the system that was to include tax credits. I personally don't recall that conversation at all, but Representative Berger certainly has it from a different point of view than I did. The reality is that the court decided that because of the way the bill was drafted, the legislature intended to include or did include the other income tax credits as an offset against the corporate minimum tax because of the way the corporate minimum tax was written into the statute and included in the same chapter as the income tax laws were. So that's the gist in the, of it. All of the estimates that I'm aware of were done at that time, were done with the assumption that it really was the absolute minimum and that a company making a lot of money or that a company having a lot of sales in Oregon, this is not an income tax. It's a minimum tax based on economic activity, not profits. That a company making a lot of sales in Oregon would pay a minimum of $100,000. Obviously, that given the graph that we've just seen, that's not what happened.
May I make one final point?
Yes, please.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the last thing I want to say is that, you know, like you, I am thinking a lot about how we can fund an adequate school year for our kids. I think right now Oregon has close to 3 fewer weeks of instructional time in our K through 12 system than the average in the country, and a lot of our kids have class sizes that are really so big that they can't learn as effectively as we all want them to be competitive in the global economy. And your statistic that in 2012 we lost $9 million in revenue through this loophole, which in my opinion is not something that was anticipated by the legislature, and that could fund 90 teachers is really compelling. And I'd be curious at some point in the future to hear what we anticipate we would lose going forward should we not fix this loophole. So thank you.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I'd be curious about that too.
Thank you. But can we stipulate that there's a disagreement about whether the legislature intended or didn't intend, and recognize Representative Bentz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative, you had a chance to avoid this, but you didn't choose to take it. So,
well, I think Representative Leininger kept me up here to ask questions, so fault. I almost got out of here.
Yeah, almost. So, Representative, my understanding of the Conway decision isn't that great, but I understand they used a tax credit.
Yes.
Which, of course, this committee's very familiar with, since we helped design those devices that allow corporations the opportunity to invest in things that we, the legislature, think are good for the state. They're hardly loopholes. They are things that we've put in place that would incent certain types of activity. For example, the tax credit one gets for crop donations to areas that need food, kids and children and folks that we all care about. There's a tax credit for that. Now, let's pretend for a moment all this is not the case. It was actually the Betsy that was using the Conway case,
which we all hate now.
But,
we talked about the Betsy when
happy
I was here
to, happy to say that I wasn't here when it was adopted. The point, though, is let's use my hypothetical, the crop donation tax credit. Let's pretend that Conway came in with it. And would you call that then a loophole exercised by the Conway folk, spending that money as we wanted them to on food, which they then donate and get a credit for food going to those starving kids across Oregon? Would you call that a loophole? And do you think that we would have been better with those kids hungry as opposed to, maybe kids getting educated? Which is it? Because I'm anxious to explore this word loophole because I wonder about it.
Before you answer the question,
be aware that I carried that bill on the floor.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Bentz, thank you for that question. I was not here in 2009 to listen to the debate and discern the legislative intent, all right? But from where I sit, okay, that might have been a discussion that, you know, maybe that's a good policy decision, maybe that's what we did. But I believe when voters passed this, we thought we were passing a minimum, irregardless of whatever policy decisions we make about crops or tax credits for textbooks or starving kids, right? Like, there's still a minimum. And my guess is that a corporation that's making in sales $100 million can somehow manage to afford $100,000 in taxes and still probably do things that help starving children. I'm just guessing. If any of those corporations are here in the audience and they want to get up here and affirm that after I'm done, I would welcome that.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Bentz, please.
So, although your answer was interesting, it wasn't responsive. So, let's go to the real interesting part of this conversation.
Okay.
And that is, who is it that should make the decision on how we spend our tax dollars? Because the point of the matter is the Conway folk were perfectly within their rights to buy up those tax credits and apply them against the minimum, because that's what the Supreme Court said. So regardless of what people thought might have been the case, the Supreme Court said otherwise. Now, let's go to the heart of the matter, however. We in this group decide that we're going to incent certain types of activity by offering tax credits, and the money then that would otherwise come to the state gets spent in that fashion. If we decide that we are going to reverse, if you will, the Supreme Court's decision, what we're basically saying is that we have created a thicket of tax regulations and offsets that we can't possibly understand or manage. Therefore, we're going to impose a minimum because we can't get the money any other way. Too many avenues have been created to avoid paying it. So don't you really think it's a declaration of surrender on our part by saying, my God, these offsets and everything else don't really work, and we don't really believe in them. Not enough, in fact, that we would force these folks to not use them.
Representative Benz, with all due respect, I think we probably just filter this very differently, right? Like, if you and I look at a series of tax credits that can be offered to incentivize certain kind of behavior, you know, I know this year your committee is dealing with a lot of them, and some of them are coming up in policy committees, and they are tax credits that probably me, a bleeding heart liberal from Southeast Portland, loves, okay? But, you know, at the same time, I go back to, I think that large corporations in this state that are making money, okay, or at least doing a very large volume of business, can afford to pay something toward the minimum, irregardless of whatever the tax credits that they may be eligible for, which may be perfectly good policy. And I think it's up to the legislature to correct this loophole. I disagree with Chair Berger, who's no longer here to serve with us, but when I voted on this and when it was campaigned for, I don't remember hearing that there was an exception for businesses if they didn't, you know, if they had tax credits that were for purposes that you and I both agree are good.
Mr. Chair, the answer was still not responsive and more argumentative, but I appreciate
it. So not very well.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Nose. You're excused to attend your other committee.
You know what? Hopefully they'll be nicer than me in the health care committee.
Hopefully so. We have two other people signed up in favor of House Bill 2107. Chuck Shekatoff and Deborah Field, if you'll come forward. Are there other people who would like to testify today on these three bills in favor of the bill? I see one. Please come forward, too. There are three chairs. There's room for another person. Yes, sir.
Me first? Okay.
Well, whatever. You're...
I'm Chuck Shekatoff, Oregon Center for Public Policy, and I'm here in support of the three bills. A little clarity, did you want to have me talk about the other components besides the minimum tax components in the bill, or do you just want on the minimum tax only?
The bill is open for public hearing, so any aspect of the bill is open for comment.
So I want to thank the committee for the opportunity to be here today. So the Department of Revenue publishes annual statistics reports on corporate and personal income taxes, and we were my organization was the one who years ago noticed that two-thirds of our corporations were paying $10, and we did the research and saw that the minimum tax was established in 1929, then the stock market crashed, and in 1939 they lowered it to $10, and 1931 lowered it to $10 and left it there untouched. Fast forward to Measure 66 and 67, they were enacted. I think the chair is correct that in all the revenue forecasts and all of that assume the minimum's the minimum. You cannot use it against other tax credits. You can use your tax credits to get down to zero on the income tax liability side. Then you compare that to the minimum tax, and if the minimum tax is more, that's what you pay. So that all happened, and then Conway Corporation had bought Betsy credits. They weren't doing something environmentally good. They just had bought the credits. They bought the tax credits. As you know, could. And they had, I don't know what their profits.
Give me just a moment. Okay. Representative Benz has a question.
That's a really good point. They bought the tax credits. Thank you, Mr. Chair. They bought the tax credits. We don't know for how much. Because when we were looking at it, perhaps you do, which would be very interesting to me. Do you know how much they paid for them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I don't know the exact amount, but I can go back and figure it and get back to you because they were set on a set amount. So you paid something like 68 cents to get a dollar's worth of credit or something like that. There was a set amount on the pass-through. So they spent a certain amount of money and got more in credit. They made money on it. Walmart did it with Solar World, for instance.
Right, and Mr. Follow, yes, please, yeah. And just to make it clear, this group had created this dollar tax credit. And then as it went out and was bid on, there was a haircut, if you will,
of 35 cents, let's say they paid 65 cents for it,
right.
And that haircut went to folks we won't mention, but bankers and or middlemen or CPAs or somebody. But the 65 cents ultimately went to the state, if you will, to help build the wind towers that created the green energy we now like. Now we can debate how much went, but they ended up paying, they being Conway, some amount for those tax credits. Now whether they didn't certainly pay the full dollar, which I think is why you're shaking your head. They got some benefit that made it worth their while to buy the tax credit. So I don't want people skipping lightly over the fact that they had to pay something out of their pocket for the tax credit. So please inform the folk as we're moving along. Don't just skip over it as though they somehow got that benefit, because they did not.
Okay.
And you know, you need to focus, if you would please, on the exact amount that, if you will, they didn't pay. Because the inference by using the word loophole is that somehow they did not pay, but they did. So please narrow your conversation so we understand how much the state truly lost.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Vance, I will, if I could finish the story, though, I will say that somebody, I don't know whose tax credit, we can look it up on the transparency website, Conway bought, and that's where they got some money back for doing some energy-related good thing. Okay, call it that, whatever. Whoever it was, I don't know who Conway bought it from. Okay, Conway, that company, whoever did that, didn't have any tax liability. And so they said, we will sell, that it was called the pass-through. And your staff might remember the rate, but there was a set rate. And so Conway bought the tax credit, bought a, let's say it was $100 worth of tax credits, for less than $100. They spent something on the order of 67 cents or something like that. I don't know. I can't remember the number.
Excuse me, the chair.
Yes, please.
They spent, you said $100, and you said 67 cents.
No, they
cents.
Got a tax credit worth $100. It would be like, I pay you $60, and I get a tax credit for $100.
Okay. You said 67 cents, and you said $100, and you meant $67.
Something on the order of 67% of the cost
there
of the credit.
Exactly.
Okay.
Thank you.
So they have these credits. They went to the Supreme Court, to the tax court, and said they calculated their taxes based on their profits, and we do not know what their profits were, and maybe applied other credits to that and got down to zero. Then they went to the minimum tax that the legislature and the voters enacted, and they had $79 million worth of sales, according to the findings in the Supreme Court case. And that meant they owed $75,000 under a minimum tax. Conway said, we want to be able to use our Betsy credits to reduce that down. And the Supreme Court said, okay. In doing that, I should point out, they did look at the language of the Betsy credit. They looked at the language of the minimum tax statute. Surprisingly, in reading the decision, I don't know why it wasn't briefed or argued, they didn't look at legislative intent. They tried to discern voter intent, as if it were an initiative put in versus a referral of one of your laws, which they should have looked at probably both. So you'd read the Supreme Court case, there's no discussion of legislative intent and going through any of that, hearings or anything. It's all whether or not there's voter intent. And they said they could reduce it. And they noted that it's somewhat based on the language in the Betsy tax credit, which relates to one of my suggestions about all the bills. So basically, my feeling is, legislative counsel made a mistake, and that's 90% of what you deal with is fixing stuff from prior years, whether it's their mistake or the advocate's mistake. They made a mistake. And so this credit got through. There's some other credits that might be able to, that also can be used against the minimum tax. The kicker can't. And I don't think anybody, your predecessors in the legislature, were being deceptive or anything when you wrote the kicker statute and said you cannot use this against the minimum tax. And the Supreme Court says very clearly that's what the kicker tax credit says, but that's not what the Betsy one does. So I think every single tax credit ought to have the clear language that the kicker tax credit has that says this cannot be used against the minimum, because I never underestimate the lawyers for the lobby looking for tax breaks to come in and find another one. And so what happened was Conway did that, and then and it's grown significantly. So as I was saying earlier, the state publishes statistical reports. We showed and went through them and confirmed it with through some emails and getting some subsequent data from the Department of Revenue that in their last report, 38 corporations paid less than the minimum tax for tax year 2011. Of those 38, at least 24, including 8 with profits in excess of $5 million, not sales, profits, paid nothing. Okay, at least 24 paid nothing. And they said in that report that number is probably going to go up because why? Companies were putting in amended returns as they're allowed to. So the latest report just recently came out, and unfortunately, Department of Revenue doesn't give us enough information about who's paying zero, but we know that 492 corporations for tax year 2012 used the tax credits to reduce their minimum tax, below the minimum tax. That's in there. What size they are and how many of them actually got to pay zero, like we know from the prior report, I think you should be asking the Department of Revenue to give you that data and give you a breakdown by size of corporation on sales and size on profits like they did in their prior report. And also maybe this 492 is probably an updated number because the report just came out. That's probably still a pretty good number, but it might be changing. So that's a lot of companies who are now paying less than the minimum. And we think the loophole ought to get closed. We don't think it should be carved out as a special one for renewable energy, just like you didn't carve out the kicker from it and some other ones that have okay language today. But you need to, I think, go through each tax credit. And it is, as the vice chair said, a bit of a morass. I don't think I don't think you're surrendering to the morass. I think you're recognizing it. Thankfully, the tax expenditure report helps you see that that we have a morass and that the spending in this committee and your counterpart on the Senate side are just as expensive in tax credits and deductions and exemptions as the Ways and Means process uses. And you should go through the morass and clear it up so that some clever lawyer doesn't find it, whether it's the crop cleaning one or whatever, that the minimum means a minimum. And that's what I think the legislature wanted. It wasn't litigated. And I think that's what the voters wanted, regardless of what the Supreme Court. Sort of, you know, frankly, because of the Supreme Court case at this point, it's mute on whether or not your intent was. They rule that there's this loophole and you need to fix it.
Thank you. Let's go on down, and we'll take questions then after all three of you have testified. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I want to thank you, first of all, for allowing me to come here today as a small business owner and concerned citizens. Mm-hmm. And
Would you introduce yourself by saying your name?
Okay, I was going to go there. Okay.
Thank you.
I'm Deborah Field. I'm here today representing small businesses. Okay, and I'm glad to have this opportunity to have my voice be heard, and that's what I wanted to make clear. I've been a small business owner for 20 years. I have a digital print and design shop in Portland, Oregon. Took time off today to come out down here. Prior to that, I spent 15 years in corporate America as a financial and tax accountant. I currently serve on the executive team of Main Street Alliance. We are a network of 2,500 small business owners contributing to our voices in public policy. I've also been back to Washington, D.C. several times to talk about issues of tax justice and fairness and money in politics. So I'm going to read the rest of my testimony here. I have come here today to remind lawmakers of the importance of small businesses in this state. Not only do we make up over 80% of the businesses, we also employ the most people. We contribute to the local economy by offering goods and services, employing the locals, and then using local services and buying local goods. We keep the money circulating in this state. But we continue to fight to level the playing field with the bigger corporations who think that their issues and importance give them the right to not pay their fair share of taxes. I feel, as well as many other small businesses, that it is our civic duty to pay our fair share of taxes. But we do not think it is right to carry the load. I am astounded by the magnitude of the big businesses that do everything in their power to avoid paying their fair share, and in many cases, not paying any taxes at all. I feel this is wrong. I have worked inside multinational tax departments, and I have witnessed how much time and effort is spent in avoiding tax. In all due respect, I do not agree with the Oregon Supreme Court decision for allowing corporations to buy. This idea of buying tax credits, it's new to me, and I don't understand it, against the minimum tax. It doesn't make any sense to me. A tax credit is earned, and it shouldn't be transferable. I don't get it. And Oregonians voted in favor of corporate minimum taxes for a reason. They believe that all corporations should pay their fair share of taxes, or at least the minimum. Oregon has the lowest corporate tax rate in the country. 50% of corporations pay only $150 minimum tax. The Conway loophole, from what I understand, allows corporations to avoid paying any taxes. Minimum tax should mean minimum tax. There should be no reason to lower the minimum tax. It ceases to be a minimum tax. 86% of the tax credits used against minimum taxes were used by corporations with over $25 million in Oregon sales. And over half of these credits were used by companies with over $100 million in Oregon sales, which saved those companies an additional $4.7 million in Oregon taxes. The Oregon Department of Revenue reported that the zero tax loophole cost nearly $9 million in 2012. Tax fairness and justice is based on a system that treats taxpayers equally. As a small business owner, I don't have the ability to buy tax credits to lower my minimum tax. And why do our biggest corporations think it is not their responsibility to pay taxes which provide public education, roads, parks, libraries, and other items that improve our state? And I could probably make an argument that the largest corporations use these services more than us small businesses. I would love to see Oregon, my native state, be a leader in the fight for tax fairness and justice. Show the rest of the country how it is done. We have done this in the past with other issues. It is time that small businesses, the backbone of the state, receive support through laws that level the playing field. Close the tax loopholes via the House bills being discussed here today, and disallow the practice of special treatment in our tax system. And in finishing, I would just like to ask that our lawmakers continue to look for ways to encourage and reward our small and big businesses to invest in our state, whether that is through tax credits or other means, instead of diminishing revenues through tax loopholes. Let's increase revenues through incentives to support our local economies, contribute to our communities, and employ our people. This is the Oregon that I wish to live in. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. First, our board asks us to take a look at tax credits, tax expenditures in general, because it's two sides of a coin. In other words, we look at the fact that low-income people pay taxes. We're a state that low-income people pay a considerable amount of taxes, but also on the other end of making sure that we have an adequate budget. I'm also here because I'm co-chair of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon Tax and Revenue Committee, and for those members who are new to the committee, have not heard us testify about our position. We've been around since the middle 1980s, and one of the things that became apparent to us as we were looking at the landscape and our needs for human service investments was that we were competing against a number of different things, and some of them we called into question. We were among those that advocated, for example, for the first tax expenditure report. We also advocated for the processes that have been set up to monitor and sunset tax credits. We have a set of principles of fairness, adequacy, stability, and transparency, which I like to joke spells out FAST, and that was an unintended kind of thing that we noticed after the fact. But in fact, we're interested in looking at all of those things from the perspective that goes back to why we were created, working on behalf of low-income people. So the Human Services Coalition was involved in the bills 66 that became 66 and 67. A number of people went out and did community workshops and discussions with people who are interested. And I certainly came away with the idea that a minimum is a minimum. I have great respect for Representative Berger. She always had very insightful ideas about working with this committee. But I do not remember any discussion about tax credits coming up with respect to what became the corporate minimum. So in conclusion, I would just say that I don't have anything technical to add to this discussion, except the Human Services Coalition would just like to see this issue resolved and fixed in accordance with the ways that the bills are before you would fix those issues. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. Just a question for, I guess, any one of the three of you. It's not really a question. Well, it is a question related to another potential source of additional credits that may be coming on after this session, if, in fact, this legislature passes the low-carbon fuel standard, because that entire program is built on a system of creating credits that can be traded, that can be bought and purchased, that will involve brokers and exchange SEC rules, all that kind of thing. So I guess I would just throw that out there, and I don't know whether you're aware of that. But secondly, if in fact that bill continues to progress through the legislature, I would hope you would show up in our House Energy Committee and provide your testimony at that time as well.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the challenge here is avoiding the demonization of corporations. They're an easy target. You should be yelling at us. If you should be saying you folks didn't write the law correctly, and that would be a much more productive, I think, exercise. The folks that the Conway folks did exactly what we allow them to do. They operated within the law. What is more interesting to me is not saying that these bad corporations are busily utilizing these loopholes. We created the loopholes. This group up here, they weren't suddenly manufactured out of whole cloth by these demonized corporations. The question is, and the one that I believe you're really trying to get at, is what are we going to do about it,
exactly.
Right? Isn't that your real point?
Yes.
So it would be easier for those of us who understand the value of a big heap of capital and how well it works to create jobs for us to more at a higher level than demagoguery discuss how best to approach this. That's my goal. And so that's why I started out the conversation with our new representative, trying to get to that point. I failed. I'm hoping that as this session goes forward, we can talk about the difference in how we decide to utilize the tax dollars that we need to make this state go. That's the most important thing, isn't it? And so to the extent we can keep what's the right word? Insightful phrases out of it, that would help me. And so I want to go back to the point that I fought my way through this morning when I was thinking about this, and that is what's the best way to manage these tax dollars? Is it through these incentives we create in the form of tax credits and deductions and all of that? Or, which I think is a highly inappropriate way, by the way, of managing our expenditures, or is it through ways and means? I think we most say, almost all say ways and means. And so we'll start from that standpoint in this debate, and I look forward to a more calm discussion as we move through this process of the next 5 months.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Davis, please.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much for your testimony today. At one point, one who testified said the Supreme Court declared that there was a loophole. Did the Supreme Court use the language of loophole in the Conway decision?
I didn't say that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Davis, no. I have not figured out.
The answer is no. It did not use the term loophole.
I don't.
So as I open up the tax expenditure report and look at various loopholes such as the earned income tax credit, child with a disability, rural medical practice, the cost of nursing care, loss of limbs, severe disability tax credit, film production, reservation enterprise, public university development, child and dependent care, and working family child care. It strikes me that much of the time that we have revenue discussions, the same groups that come before Ways and Means advocating strongly for spending in all of these areas advocate strongly to remove programs that incentivize, and I think the word incentivize was used in testimony today, remove the incentives for individuals and corporations and LLCs and sole proprietors and small businesses and large businesses in Oregon to spend money on things that in other avenues you are asking the state to spend money on. So I commend Representative Bence's advice to you that perhaps the issue is not so much what we're asking the money to be spent on. Maybe it's which committee we should be having the discussion in.
Thank you. Representative Leininger, please.
Thank you. This is an energizing and interesting conversation. Thank you for coming here and being part of it. You know, I feel like I have to note that there's definitely a distinction in my mind, at least, between you know, earned income tax credit for extremely low-income people and the question of whether a company that earns over $100 million a year in profit should be able to pay less than the corporate minimum tax. You know, I think there is a similarity in that the word tax figures into both of those senses or propositions, but it's a really different issue, and I think that we should not conflate the question of whether people who are extremely vulnerable, who can barely get by, who can barely save for meeting their basic needs, we should not conflate the idea of providing tax breaks for those people with the idea of providing tax breaks for corporations that are making a really significant profit in our state. I was really astonished by a statistic that you cited in your testimony just now, and that was 50% of Oregon corporations pay only $150 in corporate minimum tax, and of those 86% of those folks who paid no more than the corporate minimum tax had over a certain amount in sales. It was pretty significant.
$25 million
in sales who paid $150 in corporate minimum tax. You know, I mean, I'm all for strong businesses, and I come from a family rock crushing, heavy construction, road building business, and I was general counsel for a company that does manufacturing work. I'm all for us having a robust business sector, but I'm also all for us making sure that we are deriving the money that we need to pay for basic needs, services for our communities, things like roads that our communities need, things like schools that help us get a strong workforce, and safety net services. So, you know, these are important questions. You know, where we get the money that we need to run a government is an important question, but let's not suggest that tax credits to poor families are the same as $100 billion company paying a very small amount of corporation tax.
Yeah. Thank you. Other questions for this panel? Thank you very much for your testimony today. We very much appreciate it. I would call up Bob Russell and J.L. Wilson, who've indicated that they are opposed to two of the three measures. Just on their sign up, I suspect they also have the same position on the third one, but I'm not certain. Is there anyone else here who would like to speak in opposition? There's another chair. I don't see anyone. Gentlemen, please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations, and I am representing the Oregon Trucking Associations today. Although Conway is one of my members, I am not specifically representing them. What I wanted to point out to you on these three bills, and I'm only speaking to the decision in the Conway court case. There's other pieces to some of these bills, and I'm not speaking to that at all. is that there may be an unintended consequence from what we're doing here. And I thought that I would just give you an example, and actually Conway is the perfect example. Conway has a campus in Northwest Portland that probably you don't know belongs to Conway because there's no trucks there. And they employ about 1,200 people, mostly professionals and technical staff that support their nationwide operations. It's an administrative campus. Because of that, the cost from those excellent paying jobs are offset against the revenues that they derive in the state, and that's why they're down there at the corporate minimum. There are some tax credits that you recently enacted. Matter of fact, last year you enacted tax credits that encourage trucking companies to purchase vehicles that are powered by natural gas instead of by diesel. I don't know whether or not Conway is going to purchase natural gas trucks in Oregon. They have purchased natural gas trucks in other parts of the country. But certainly the incentive that you intended in with those particular tax credits is dramatically reduced if Conway cannot use them to reduce their corporate minimum. So I just wanted to point that out to you, and be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, my name is J.L. Wilson on behalf of Associated Oregon Industries, and I just wanted to put on the record that we would oppose the three bills. AOI has historically been opposed and currently opposed to the corporate minimum based on gross receipts, and that's one of the distinctions I want to make because there's some uncertainty about how C-Corps are taxed. The $150 corporate minimum that's been alluded to is really for pass-through entities, the S-Corps, the sole proprietors, LLCs, and those that pay their business taxes through their personal income. Tax. The C-Corp tax is based on sales, based on gross sales. It doesn't have a bearing on profit, hence the seeds of AOI's opposition to how business is taxed in that regard. I know that there's concern, there's been expressed concern about the $9 million that have been lost through the Conway decision. And there's just a couple things I want to add to this discussion. First of all, your C-Corp stepped up to the plate significantly in the 2013 special session by voluntarily taxing themselves, those with net income above $1 million up to $10 million, moved that rate from 6.6 to 7.6, and that was voluntarily done by C-Corps, who wanted to contribute to a solution to deliver a greater funding package to schools. No one had to force us to do that, but we did that on our own. That was some $50, $60 million per biennium tax increase levied on C-Corps. The other point I'd like to make is the reason C-Corp taxes or corporate taxes are among the lowest in the country is quite simply because we don't have a sales tax. And I would say that one thing, an enduring characteristic of the business community has been a willing and a willfulness to engage in the tax reform discussion, even if that does mean a sales tax, and even if that does mean ultimately that business pays more in taxes. Business has always wanted to drive that effort and be part of that discussion. So it's not an unwillingness to pay more. We simply don't support a minimum tax based on sales, and it is divorced from profitability. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Pence?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Dale, I think you touched upon much more clearly than I did earlier in my so-called questions. The challenge in the discussion is finding that point of reference, which what you just said, profit, is a pretty good point of reference. And that what I've heard is the kind of loose use of the term not paying any tax, although there's been $100 million worth of income. And I'm guessing that nothing could be further from the truth. All kinds of taxes are paid by these businesses in the form of whether FICA tax or whether it's property tax or whether it's a business tax or any other number of taxes that have little regard to do with the amount of sales. And thus, the common denominator is, are you making any money? And what I fear is that the minimum device, that is, we're going to extract money from you no matter what, the no regard to profit. What ends up happening then in a smart business is they will simply discontinue paying what might have been a charitable contribution or something else that reduced profit and go ahead and pay the state. That's why I think the more interesting thing would be, what is the way that we want to spend the state's tax dollar? Do we want to put this minimum in place knowing full well that smart business people will manage that minimum just like they manage all their other business decisions? That's really the issue, isn't it? Is this a wise thing to do, and is it consistent with the rest of our tax policy? I would suggest that much more discussion needs to be held in that regard, a complex matter. Am I getting closer to the point? Please say yes.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Good. Great. Yes, Representative Whitsitt, please.
This is a real general question. I was just wondering if you could discuss what you believe your clients, who you represent in your industry as a whole, will stand to lose if these bills go through, i.e. numbers of businesses and employment that may be lost in this state. Have they relayed that to you? I know it's really broad, but...
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, not specifically, but when I first came to the state of Oregon, we had a number of fairly large businesses that were headquartered here, and we have lost a lot of those businesses. They've moved their headquarters elsewhere for a variety of reasons. I guess what I'm suggesting to you is that the discussion that we're having today may be one of those reasons.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. With that, we will close the public hearings on two of these three bills, House Bill 2107 and House Bill 2487, and open an additional public hearing on House Bill 2688. Yes?
Did you close these two?
I did. Well, I meant to close 2096 and 2107. If I said something else, I misspoke. And we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2688 and call on Representative Gomberg. And Representative, we have two bills open at the moment, 2688 that we're opening now and 2076 from which we heard Representative Nose and then these other gentlemen as you came in.
I understand, Mr. Chairman. And again, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much, members of the committee. For the record, Representative David Gomberg from House District 10. I'm pleased to appear here today in support of Section 1 of House Bill 2688 and Section 2 of House Bill 2076. The wording and the anticipated outcomes are identical. First, a little background, if I may. In 2013, we passed tax reductions for 78,000 Oregon S corporations and LLCs. My proposal before you today is to expand that program by 10%, adding roughly 7,800 more businesses that would benefit from lower tax rates. This bill would accomplish that goal while leaving 99.6% of tax filers who benefited from our recent changes unaffected. The proposal is virtually revenue neutral. And finally, I'm advocating for predictability and stability in this tax program. Now, what we're talking about here, members of the committee, are Oregon's smallest businesses. These are the folks that use their experience, their creativity, and their economic courage to try and make something out of nothing. Nike started in someone's garage. Intel started on a kitchen table. Leatherman began on a workbench. And I'm convinced that Oregon's next great success story is out there somewhere. All they need is a little encouragement, a few necessary resources, and then for us to get out of the way. This was precisely the goal of the small business tax cuts that made up part of the 2013 grand bargain. That measure sought to equalize tax rates between C corporations and S corporations, or LLCs, that had at least one full-time employee who was not a principal in the company. Now, I supported the grand bargain revenue package, and I thank the governor and the Republican and Democratic leadership for bringing this important concept forward. But after the dust had settled, I began to look at the numbers and realized that we could have done much better. Because what I learned from legislative revenue analysis was that about 78,000 company owners qualified for this new tax break, and 44,000 of them, about 57%, are scheduled to receive an average of $139. $139. Well, that's not my idea, Mr. Chairman, of economic incentives or meaningful tax reform. At the same time, we learned that the 254 owners whose income exceeds $1 million will receive an average of $41,000. That's more than the average worker in my district earns in a year. Now, please let me be clear that I have nothing against businesses that make money. I admire them, I respect them, and frankly, one day I'd like to be one of them. But the fact remains that the third of a percent making more than $1 million will receive much more than the 57% at the bottom income end. Said another way, 254 established firms will receive almost twice as much as the 44,000 who are struggling to get on their feet. Now, as I said, I share those numbers with you as background. My proposals today are more about who was not included in the grand bargain rather than who was. And again, let me be clear that my goal is to substantially increase the number of companies that qualify for these important benefits. The measure we passed requires qualifying companies to have a full-time, year-round employee. Now, that doesn't work very, very well for many seasonal and smaller businesses. It doesn't work well in rural economies. In short, it doesn't work well in my district, and I would think in many of yours. We've left out farmers. We've left out fishermen. We've left out construction. We've left out tourism. And we've left out firms that hire working seniors or working parents. So my proposal, as you can see, is to reduce the number of weekly hours and annual hours necessary to become part of the bargain. By including companies that hire part-time workers, legislative revenue tells me that 7,800 more taxpayers will qualify for the break. 7,800 more. And they tell me they will receive an average of $900 each. That leaves us with the question of how we pay for all of this. My proposal is to limit the tax reduction to the first $1 million of income. Up to $1 million of taxable income, you still get the entire break. After that, any additional income reverts to the old rate. Our best estimate is that these fortunate people will still be saving about $25,000 a year. As I indicated before, this limit would affect only about 254 out of 78,000 firms. That means that 99.6% of the affected businesses would see no change at all. And the small percentage who do see a change are still receiving that substantial benefit of $25,000. Now, what kind of S-Corps and LLCs are in this upper bracket? Our research suggests that they are primarily law firms, doctors, and similar professional groups. The overall difference would be $8 to $10 million in revenue, close to the projected $7 million in cost. So given the preliminary nature of these numbers, it's suggested that this is within an inch of a neutral revenue exchange. Now, finally, I've spoken to this committee before about predictability and stability in public policy, and I've expressed a concern that the open-ended nature of our recent legislation might encourage firms to change their tax status to seek out savings. There's nothing wrong with doing that. The problem is that we don't know how many firms will shift or what the effect on revenue might be. So capping the break at $1 million will benefit firms that presently qualify without providing a major incentive for other companies to reclassify. The details of these changes are incorporated in two bills before you today. Both have other elements as well, but the change to part-time and the $1 million cap is what I came to present. And I'm proud to add that my measure is co-sponsored by as many Republicans as it is Democrats. So I hope this is not perceived as a partisan measure, sponsored by as many Republicans as Democrats. We expand the tax cut to 77,800 more taxpayers. We leave 99.6% unaffected. And for the fraction of a percent who are limited, they still get about $25,000. I believe it's a good bill that helps a lot of micro and seasonal Oregon businesses that are working hard to succeed and to put other Oregonians to work. It's the chance to do something real for Oregon's smallest businesses, and I urge you to move it forward. Out there in Oregon right now, small entrepreneurs dream of being the next Leatherman or Columbia Sportswear or Rogue Brewing. Oregon would be much better off if they succeeded. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Questions for Representative Gomberg. Representative Whitsitt, please.
I was wondering, do I understand this correctly, that you would do a carve-out for tax credits for renewable energy resource equipment manufacturing facilities alone?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Whitsitt, that is a second section of 2688, and I would respectfully defer to the chair of the committee since that section was added at his request last year.
Oh, I see. Yeah, the answer to the question is that the reference to ORS 315.341 is the manufacturing Betsy, and I think this is actually extraneous to your bill. It's to clarify the rule of the concerning the Betsy that was requested by the Business Oregon, wasn't it? Didn't they ask for this change?
Mr. Chair, I don't. And there were several discussions about when the manufacturing Betsy was scheduled to sunset in 2014, there were many discussions about somehow modifying that policy to move it forward. So this could be a placeholder for that concept.
Yes.
It wasn't necessarily that per se, because that was really limited. It was mainly, it is the renewable energy manufacturing facilities primarily used by solar panel manufacturers. It was opened up to, it was available for anything. And in prior discussions over the past year and a half, the policy options were somehow maybe making it a more broad investment tax credit, not just for that particular industry.
All right. I don't know exactly why we picked on Representative Gomberg's bill. And in fact, until just now, I didn't realize this was something I had done. So I don't know whether I actually did it or not. But I do recall that the department asked for a clarification because they were concerned about tax credits that would expire before people could actually do the planned work. And I don't think it has anything whatever to do with Representative Gomberg's legislative concept.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. Representative Whitsitt, I'm here specifically to address Section 1 of 2688, which is the exact same language. It's in Section 2 of 2076.
Needless to say, we will get an answer to your question. I'd like to know it, too.
Okay.
Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've talked with you previously about the bill, and it has some interesting aspects. There are several other things that I would think might help that law work better. So I'm looking forward to further conversation on it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? So you see, you've escaped without a substantive question on your concept so far.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not the first time I presented it, and there were more questions last time, so we're doing well.
We are. And there are some other people who want to testify who presumably will answer some more of those questions. And I've been waiting for this opportunity for a long time, and I finally get it. Two people who have signed up to speak in favor of your bill, and I'll call them both at once, Chuck Sheketoff and J.L. Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Can we applaud? Is that allowed?
Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on this bill today? Please, come forward.
I'll sit to his left.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Chuck Sheketoff, Oregon Center for Public Policy. I'm here in support of House Bill 2688. I accept for the reinstatement of the manufacturing Betsy. I think that
I don't know. I wasn't sure how that got in the bill, and so I think
we'll figure that out.
I think, but as you know, I was a critic of the tax bill that was in the so-called grand bargain, and I think this bill does a takes a good step, it's not enough, to scale it back for who's getting the benefiting from it. And so I'll leave it at that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. Members, for the record, J.L. Wilson representing the Oregon State Chamber of Commerce on this issue and on House Bill 2688. And there's probably no other issue that they're actually more excited about than this particular concept. And I've committed to the sponsor and others. I think this is a very, very viable concept. We support, obviously, the provisions of the bill with the exception of the Manny credit. And my other sort of caveat is it needs to be revenue neutral and preserve the integrity of the revenue component of the grand bargain agreement. But in terms of casting the net out wider for thousands of small companies, and here's something I want to be clear about. We're talking about shareholders of those companies. I think that there's some notion that these are company taxes, that you're actually talking about shareholders of those companies for whom the income passes through. But to cast the net out to 7,000 additional small business shareholders, to me, just seems like a significant opportunity to give, you know, for me, you know, retained earnings are the name of the game and cash flow. And to be able to do that for small companies through this bill, I think is a real it's a good thing. So, like I said, support the concept of House Bill 2688. Would only recommend minor tweaks, not the least of which is removing the Manny piece of it. But I think this is well worth further discussion and moving forward with.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here on behalf of the Manny tweaks, because I like to say that on the record. 2688 is a good bill. We liked it a lot when Representative Gumberg mentioned it to us, the notion during the grand bargain and other tax discussions about small business tax relief, particularly for sub-S and other sorts of pass-through entities like most of my membership is. It didn't get to us. This does, because of the reduction in hours worked annually. I think it was going to be a huge benefit to a lot of small construction companies that have some workers, but not enough to really trigger under the small business protections that were there earlier. As was discussed earlier, the content of the bill, we support the tweaks as it goes forward. I think we'd like to be part of that conversation, is to make sure that it is targeted the way we would like to see in the first batch of legislation on this topic targeted, to make sure we're actually providing small business tax relief to small businesses. But with that, it's a nice to be in front of your committee, Mr. Chairman, in favor of something. It doesn't happen often, likely may not happen again all that often. Look forward to this working on this bill and be glad to take any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative Vance.
Mr. Chair, there's a provision, and this is one of the things that I would probably be discussing with the sponsor of the bill, and it's the fact that up in 1B there's a exclusion of capital gains. This has an unfortunate impact on timber folk, and it's I don't want to dredge all that up from back in the grand bargain days, but there is a problem there that I will be bringing to the attention of the committee. And there's also another modest problem that has to do with what I'm going to say, gaming the legislation, which I don't think any of us are in favor of, and I'll be making a suggestion regarding that also. And it was kind of a cleanup effort that I think would make the bill work where the way we want it to work. So I'll be bringing those two changes to the sponsor and in the form of an amendment.
Very good. Other questions, comments? We need a photograph. Thank you very much.
Smile for the camera.
Thank you. Appreciate it. With that, we'll close the public hearings on House Bill 2076 and House Bill 2688. Colleagues, I'd like to open a work session on the bill introduction. I think we're all here. Yes, we'll open a work session on bill introduction. Representative Bentz, I think we have one today.
Sure, I move LC 3747, dated 1/27/15, be introduced as a committee bill.
Thank you. Representative Bentz moves LC 3747 be introduced as a committee bill, all with the usual caveats. Is there any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Without objection, it is so ordered. We close the work session on bill introduction, open a public hearing on House Bill 2487. Kyle, you want to introduce the bill?
Sure. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, member of the committees. House Bill 2487 comes to us from the Department of Revenue. And what the measure will do is it requires a correction of maximum assessed value resulting from assessor changes in property square footage to be in proportion to the change in the real market value of the property and the changes of the square footage. So this differs a little bit in right now. If there's a change, it would be in proportion to the maximum assessed value. We're now under what this bill would do, it would line it up with the value, the real market value of the property.
Great. We have three signed up on this bill, Mr. Phillips, Mr. Waldorf, and Mr. Schmidt. And they're all in favor. Is there, just while they're sitting down, is there anyone else who plans to speak on this bill today? I don't see any. Gentlemen, please, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Phillips of the Oregon Department of Revenue. Thank you for hearing 2487. This bill deals with the way maximum assessed value is treated when certain errors are discovered. Maximum assessed value is that concept that came about when Measure 50 passed in 1997. And really, when that passed, there was nothing in the Constitution about maximum assessed value ever going down. There was a provision for it to go up by 3%. And so that has always been the case until a series, maybe a handful of bills have passed since then to allow maximum assessed value to go down. One of those was brought by the county assessors in 2001. And they said, well, look, when maximum assessed value is set and it can only go up 3%, but then later we discover that we've made an error on an account where we thought the square footage was much larger, for example, than what it truly is, the homeowner, let's say, calls us, or the commercial owner calls us, we go out to the property, and in fact, they're correct. So we want to adjust the square footage to be the correct amount, and we basically, if that reduces the market value of the property, then we reduce the market value. But then they have to look at the maximum assessed value, because that was set, and it never went down. So the bill was brought forward and said, look, if we find an error, we'd like to reduce the maximum assessed value for the value of that square footage. But the way it was worded at that time was that it was proportional. It was proportional to the reduction in market value. That's all well and good, except that there's a principle in appraisal that says not all square footage is of equal value. And so if you have a property that you add that really doesn't add value to the property, and I use in my testimony, I just made up something like, if you add a bathroom to a house, that's really important. You're not going to be able to sell the house without that. But if you add a second, third, fourth, and fifth one, there becomes a diminishing value of that additional space. And so not all value is equal. So the assessors and the department got together and said, well, let's make this adjustment to a maximum assessed value a portion based on the reduction in market value. So if it reduces it a lot, then a lot is reduced. If it reduces it a little in value, little is reduced. And that's the essence of this bill. So we just want to change how the assessors can change the maximum assessed value to property when there's an error in square footage. And this can work. It can work as an increase, or it can work as a decrease. So, but in no case would it actually increase anybody's taxes.
Thank you. Please go ahead, and then we'll take questions.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Douglas Schmidt. I'm the Polk County Assessor. Over the last couple of years, we have worked with the department to try and resolve this, and the assessors are in agreement with this change. I'm the immediate past president of the Assessors Association. We worked on the bill over this last year. Just as a quick example of, we're talking about square footage not necessarily being the same. In Polk County, if we had testimony I've submitted. This is on the second page of my written testimony. An average quality home built in 2011 that has 1,500 square feet on the first floor and 700 square feet in an attic. That would equate to a market value of about just under $182,000. So The homeowner lets us know that they believe the square footage in the attic is, this is a finished attic, is incorrect, and it could be because we didn't get an interior inspection when the property was built. They modified the plan slightly to not include an area. It could be any number of reasons. So we go out, we remeasure that new square footage. There's 200 square feet less in the attic. That square footage drop is a 10% of the total square footage of the house. But when you look at the value that's attributable to that 200 square feet, it only amounts to a 4.3% reduction. So we believe that adjusting the maximum assessed value, which was originally created by the market value, is a better mechanism to correctly reflect the record, the roll.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm Randy Wall from Multnomah County Assessor and the current president of the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. I'm here available to answer any questions. The testimony has been pretty complete to this point, so thank you.
Thank you. Representative Witsit, please.
I was wondering, will it be up to the individual assessor in the individual county to decide what the value of, say, a third bathroom is in, say, Lake Oswego versus in Klamath Falls, in a $1 million house versus a $125,000 house, or, you know, a percentage thereof that bathroom? Is this going to just come down to the individual county assessor?
I'll answer that one. Chair Barnhart, Representative Witsit, Randy Wall from Multnomah County. The short answer is yes. Basically, it's the same way we would come up with a current exception event under Measure 50. We would be appraising the property with the work done and without the work done. So here what we do is we appraise the property with our wrong characteristics, so to speak, the definition of the property, and then we appraise it without, and the difference is the value change. So my appraiser will go out there, they'll reappraise the property, and if the reduction Mr. Schmidt says in his testimony is very illustrative. If it's 4%, it's 4%. Yes, it could be different anywhere in the state because it's based on every single market factor. Within my Multnomah County area, we have 168 neighborhoods, and in those neighborhoods, virtually the same property will have a slightly different value in every one of those neighborhoods. And that's how their original value in MAV was established, based on their specific market factors. So that's how this fix is what we believe would be most fair and equitable, is let's fix it in the same way that the wrong value occurred.
Can I follow up?
Yes, please. Mr. Phillips, did you have something to add to that?
Mr. Chair, yes, Representative Witsit, I might add to that in line 26 of the bill, there's an existing provision that's not proposed to be changed, and that is that just like any property value every single year, once that amount is determined, the taxpayer can appeal that if they disagree.
So did I hear you say that you don't anticipate increasing what the person pays through this bill? This is not going to be a tax, and you're saying that, right? Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Witsit. This is only for decreases in maximum assessed value.
Thank you.
It's very taxpayer friendly.
Right. Mm-hmm. The core of this bill, if I understand it, is lines 15 through 19, isn't it? Where you where you remove a mandatory piece and you change it to a piece that is designed to reflect market value rather than a mathematical relationship between the new square footage and the old square footage.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. That's what you said, and I was parsing the language to see if I think it does that. I think probably it does.
Okay. We think so.
Yeah. But up till now, when you had one of these adjustments to be made, you were required by this statute to make an adjustment based on the proportion of the actual square footage against what you thought it was before.
Mr. Chair, yes. Whenever an adjustment was to be made under this statute and the assessor decided to make that adjustment, they would have to use the existing law formula, which sometimes represented the value, but sometimes it did not.
Even if the market value might actually be different than that number, either higher or lower.
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Any other questions on this bill? With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2487 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2486. We have the same two of the same people on this bill. You might as well stay there, Mr. Phillips, Mr. Waldorf, and we add Mr. Howe. Yeah, and go ahead, Kyle. Give us the particulars.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Once again, this is a measure brought to us by the Department of Revenue, and what the measure does is it eliminates the requirement that all urban renewal revenue be categorized as subject to the $10 limitation per $1,000 of real market value under the Measure 5 constitutional limits. So just a reminder, we have the $10 limit, and then education is under the $5 per $1,000 limits. The municipality that activated the urban renewal plan, this is generally going to be cities, but in some cases it can be counties, will, in their notice filed with the county assessor, will have to provide a description of how much each amount of revenue under the urban renewal plan will go to education side or to the general government side. There's some removal of statutory provisions that were held unconstitutional by the Oregon courts.
Okay.
And I would just mention that in the we do have two court cases are in the meeting materials. It's the first one is, I'll try to pronounce it, Urhausen versus Eugene, and then also Shilin versus Multnomah County. So both those kind of discuss what this bill does, or in some things what this bill is related to. And then it applies to property tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2016.
Very good. Mr. Phillips.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. The department brought House Bill 2486 because of some court cases that speak to this issue in the statute. The other bill was regarding Measure 50. This one's regarding Measure 5. So we're going all the way back to 1990. And in that measure, the measure created two categories, one called general government, one called education. And so local governments would have to categorize their levies and taxes under one of those two categories. Generally, the general government was referred to things like what a city might do or what a county might do, a park and recreation district might do. And that category was limited to $10 per thousand of real market value. The Constitution also created what's called an education category, and that was for monies expended for education. So districts like school districts and education service districts and community college would categorize generally under the education category, and that category is limited to $5 per thousand. So when you add up all the levies and the tax rates, you can't exceed that, and if you do, it's compressed down to that ratio. So that's where you get the word compression, which I won't mention again because more confusing, and it doesn't really relate. So anyway, local governments then every year categorize their levies for the assessor. The assessor puts it into that category, and on we go, except for urban renewal agencies that don't categorize their taxes. And that's because, for the most part, the assessor is charged with the responsibility of calculating that. The urban renewal agency doesn't necessarily know how much that's going to be because of a really complicated math formula and the way its urban renewal taxes are done. So what happened was is that was put into statute, and it said basically in 310.150 and 310.155, there's three sections that refer to urban renewal increment revenue and urban renewal special levies being categorized under the general government category. And I think that was probably because urban renewal agency's task or job or obligation, authority, is to remove blight. And typically that is to improve areas that encourage businesses to move in and develop. So historically, there have not been any discussions about urban renewal agencies having their taxes categorized into the education category because they didn't do education-type things with their money. But that has changed a little bit with some agencies contemplating expending monies for schools, buildings, and educational purposes. So what this bill does is it essentially says don't require urban renewal tax increment and special levies to be in the general government category. Allow the urban renewal agency to, just like all other local governments, tell the assessor what category to put it in. And this is because the court in Urhausen that I'm going to cite, and I've quoted it in my testimony, The court said property tax revenues are deemed to be dedicated for funding the public school system if the revenues are exclusively used for educational purposes. So the court was focusing on the end use of the money, not the entity that was actually levying or imposing the tax. So the assessors don't really know how local governments are planning to spend their money. It shouldn't be up to them to make that judgment. And since all other local governments categorize their taxes, this bill would say the Urban Renewal Agency should categorize their taxes and the assessor will put it on the roll that way. So I guess the four main points I want to make is this bill does not require the agencies to categorize under any particular category. The bill does not lower taxes for schools. The bill is consistent with the Constitution as determined by the court. And the bill does not preempt a challenge by anyone, a citizen, another taxing district, anyone from challenging a categorization. And that's currently the case for any categorization of any local government. So with that, I urge your passage.
Thank you. Mr. Walrath.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm Randy Walrath from Oklahoma County Assessor. My testimony today basically is our first read of this. We had concerns about the language, and at this point, on the current language, it has the Urban Renewal District telling us a percentage. That way we can calculate it. We've already reprogrammed our computer system. We're in the process of testing it now. We use a software platform that is one of 8 or 9 other counties use. I have not surveyed the other counties yet. There's primarily 3 platforms used in the state. For us, it was a pretty minor tweak, so I cannot say at this time what it will be for the other 2 computer systems being used. But primarily, for us from Oklahoma County, we generally have some of the most complex urban renewal calculations. The bill as written, we can perform.
Thank you. Mr. Howe.
My name is Greg Howe. I was the attorney in the Urhausen case. Actually, I'm here to thank you. This is a housekeeping measure. It's overdue. It's a good thing to do. The DOR has already changed its regulation, and it just remains to have the statute do the same. I have a long argument I could make, but it's it, since everybody here seems to be in agreement, and he's the guy that matters, and so does he, I'm the guy that brings cases, and I've got another one going on challenging the categorization, but I don't have anything else to add here.
Thank you. Did we mess up your categorization argument with the new language in here?
Oh, no. Everything's fine. If I had to write it, I would have probably not done as good a job, but it's perfect. It's what it should. It's what I argued for 2 years ago but didn't get anywhere.
Okay. So what I understand from what you said, and I think what the other two gentlemen said, is that this essentially conforms the statutes to what the court has told us the Constitution requires. Is that a fair statement?
That is a fair statement. The Shiloh case is the controlling case. 14 times the court said it's how you use the taxes that matter.
Right.
And that's all this is doing.
Thank you. Other questions for this panel? Representative Whitsett, please.
Yes, I was just wondering how many cities or counties, is it cities that have urban renewal projects that would fall under this law?
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsett, one urban renewal agency that we are aware of had considered and actually proceeded toward levying or imposing taxes for an educational purpose that we know of, and they have since just declined to proceed with that. It's my understanding.
So
yes,
at this point, then?
I'm sorry?
At this point, I'm trying to find out, are you saying none?
There are no agencies that are doing it now, or are there more than zero?
We think right now there's none, but we also don't, I mean, we get that from the newspaper. I mean, we don't know how urban renewal agencies are spending their money. That's not our job to track that down.
Mr. Howe?
The answer is one, and that's Multnomah, that's the PDC. We are currently in court, in the tax court. PDC demolished its education urban renewal district and instead are now saying that the money they're giving to Portland State University isn't for education. And we are litigating that now.
And PDC is the Portland Development Corporation?
Portland Development Commission.
Commission. Thank you. Those of us not from Portland aren't familiar with the initials. Mr. Phillips?
And Mr. Chair, as I pointed out earlier, anyone can challenge a categorization, and that's exactly how it's playing out for Mr. Howe. The Urban Renewal Agency has to categorize under this bill, but then anybody can challenge that categorization. I don't know who will win, but that's the way the process should work.
And forgive a perhaps not very bright question, but I assume that the reason why people are trying, why the city of Eugene, Portland, and other people are trying, have tried to do this, is that it would have the tendency of moving out of a category which is saturated into one, or is in compression, I guess is the correct language, into one that it may be less compressed or not compressed, and that the court has basically said, no, you can't do that.
Mr. Chair, John Phillips, the Department of Revenue, I'm not really 100% sure about the motivations. I think functionally that you're correct that could be a motivation. Another one might be there's so much money generated often for urban renewal agencies that's not then or hasn't been traditionally spent on education purposes, that there's an interest in sharing some of that.
Mr. Howe, did you have something in response to my question?
I think I know their motivation, but I'm an attorney, so what do I know?
Right. Thank you. I was trying to understand why this controversy was happening at all. And in any event, it is an attempt on the part of these entities to shift funds to an educational use that, under the traditional use of that agency, would have gone to some other use.
Mr. Chair, that might be correct, although I just can't speak to their motivation.
Thank you. Representative Leininger?
Well, thank you for talking to us about urban renewal. I'm formerly a Clackamas County Commissioner, and we've had a lot of conversations about urban renewal in Clackamas, and I've had a chance to think a lot about it. One of the things that I think is important for all of us to be aware of is that urban renewal, while it can be used to good effect, even if this is simply a housekeeping measure, it does have a significant impact on schools. I think I've read that in the last biennium, $80 million in tax revenue that would have gone to the state government to be divided up among various purposes didn't go there because of urban renewal keeping tax rates in place and diverting the spread to support amortization of the construction financing under urban renewal. So I do think it's an important thing for us to think about how we legislate around urban renewal issues. But the second thing that makes me curious and a little bit concerned about this is, if it were the case that this housekeeping change or this proposed change enables taxing districts to apportion the urban renewal value to a different category, perhaps to move away from a compressed category to a category where there's more opportunity to get urban renewal money to projects, does that create a barrier if the local community, say, wants to pass a school funding measure? Say, you know, now that value is attributed to the education category instead of the general government category. Say that same community wants to go out and pass a school funding measure. Does the movement of classification from general government to education make it harder for a local community to be able to raise revenue for schools because that territory is already occupied by urban renewal?
Mr. Chair, Representative Leininger.
It's Leininger.
Leininger.
You're welcome
I'm sorry.
To say whatever you
I'm
want.
Sorry. Leininger. My apologies. I think we've had a number of examples around the state where local governments that are typically considered general governments, like cities, have levied local options and used them for school purposes. And I don't think this bill has anything to do with that. It simply says that it's up to the local government to categorize it on how they're going to use the monies. And it doesn't dictate how money is used by any local government. But it just says, look, if you're going to do it, you need to comply with the Constitution.
So may
Please,
I just ask
yeah.
a follow-up? So mm-hmm. I guess my only follow-up would be because it's of paramount importance to me that we not at any point intrude on the money that local communities can use to fund their schools. I feel like I'll be interested in hearing from an education community representative about whether or not they are 100% on board with this change. Thanks.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Howe, please.
I'd just like to finish with one thought.
Please.
This actually is a truth in taxation measure. The law requires that a taxing entity disclose and categorize how they're using the taxes, whether it's for schools or not for schools. An urban renewal agency needs to report that on a form called UA50. If they're going to use it for schools, all this measure does is say so. That's it. Doesn't require them to spend any money on schools or not spend money. It just is, if you're going to, say so. It's a truth question.
Thank you. Representative Davis?
Mr. Chair, I think I may have the same question as Representative Leininger.
Let's pursue that, shall we?
Which, as I'll try to distill it in my own mind, is by allowing the flexibility or accuracy, so to speak, in this bill of an urban renewal taxing district to be applied to the education category, because right now it's applied per se to the general government category, is there a risk that it would to accurately list an urban rural district in education, it could result in compression in the compression district where it is not currently in place?
You're getting head nod from Mr. Howe.
Yes, no question about that. It is possible, but the Constitution has been interpreted by the Supreme Court to require taxing entities to disclose how they're going to use the funds they take in property taxation. If you don't change this, the Supreme Court will continue to say it's not constitutional, I'm afraid.
Yeah, the case in Eugene, and you'll help me if I mess this up, I think came out of a decision by the City Council to attempt to raise money that would apply toward schools, toward a variety of things having to do with recreation and some other things that I'm a little bit vague on at this point. And if I understand the case, what the case basically said was you can't take money out of the $10 limit and move it to activities that are limited by the $5 limit. Is that an act? And I'm getting a head nod from the guy who litigated the case. So I think that's what that was about. Now, frankly, I tell you, I was very much in favor of the attempt. The Supreme Court said we couldn't do it.
Did the assessor have? I apologize.
Please go ahead, Representative Davis.
Yeah. Randy Wall from Montgomery County.
Yes.
Chair, Representative Davis. The answer to your question generally is we have not tested this yet, but based on our experience, if you have since compression is done on a property by property basis and education and general government are done separately, generally we find that many times general government starts to compress sooner than education. So the answer to this is, and I don't know, but I just texted with my person that does all our rate making, and the only way to really have the answer is to go back and rerun our roll, which would be quite time consuming. And she can do it. We're the only accountant that I believe can do it, but it does take her about a week to do it with scenarios. But generally, with the premise that a property is in full compression on both residential and on both sides of the coin here, if you move from one to the other, then you will be reducing those funds for where you move it to.
Mm-hmm. Activist county, activist governments like Portland, Multnomah County, and Lebanon often find themselves in compression this way, whereas otherwise it's mostly school districts, I think, isn't it, around the state where that happens, like in Eugene, places like that where levies get passed fairly readily. I think it's in places where there's a lot of activism on the part of governments or school districts that you find compression, and other places you don't. Is that, Mr. Phillips, is that a rough rule of thumb? Is that reasonably accurate?
Mr. Chair, I think that as a rule of thumb, that's accurate. And since compression occurs on a property-by-property basis, it's not really possible to say that any particular school district, but it does tend to happen more often in communities that are supporting their schools or their local governments.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you, gentlemen. And with that, we'll close the public hearing. Colleagues, I thought I was going to get us out of here before the end of the meeting time, but in fact, we're 2 minutes over. I apologize. See you tomorrow. With that, the committee is adjourned.